I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. Documentaries used to be films with a bunch of talking heads. But nowadays, more docs capture reality as it accidentally unfolds in front of the camera. Who are some of the directors who led this shift to more reality-based films? My guest today is one such pioneer, Albert Maysles, whom the New York Times calls the Dean of Documentary Filmmaking. Albert has made over 36 films of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Truman Capote, and his film Grey Gardens is now a Broadway show.
In 1964, I remember sitting at my desk answering the phone. It was the Granada Television from England calling, saying that the Beatles are arriving in 2 hours in New York. Would you like to make a film of them? I put my hand over the phone and turned to my brother and said, "Who are the Beatles? Are they any good?"
Coming up, we'll learn how Albert helped to build a new documentary genre from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, the founder of Maysles Films, a documentary film company. Albert has been a pioneer in the documentary film world since the 1960s. He's one of the creators, along with his brother David, of a modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. Welcome. Albert, I'd love to know what year you were born.
1926. I just celebrated my 80th birthday, believe it or not. But there it is.
Do you feel 80?
Not at all. Not at all.
Where did you grow up?
Boston.
How did your parents meet? Were they Bostonians to begin with?
Oh, they met very romantically in Boston, of course. At noontime, they would meet at a street, particular street corner every day and have lunch. What my mother didn't know was that my father would arrive 5 or 10 minutes early, place himself across the street behind a window and just look at her.
Oh. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother was a school teacher. In those days, in the 30s and even in the 40s, teaching in Boston was, for a woman, was restricted only to women who weren't married. And so they were all spinsters. And so my mother was married, so she couldn't teach in Boston. So we moved to Brookline, and there she found she couldn't teach because she was Jewish, and there weren't any Jewish teachers. So she had to convince the superintendent of schools that she'd be a teacher, and he allowed her to be what's called a permanent substitute. And she was very devoted to civil rights. Her one dream was to spend some time with Mrs. Roosevelt, and she did. Spent a whole day with her. Many, many years later, when I came back from my first trip to Russia, where I made a film in mental hospitals, I read in the paper that she was going to Russia. This was 1956. She was going to look into social services. She wanted to visit mental hospitals, but she had heard that there weren't any. So I called her up and told her, indeed, there were. In fact, I made this film. Oh, come on over and bring your projector. So I spent a whole day, as my mother did, I spent a whole day with Mrs. Roosevelt.
And what did your dad do?
My father was a postal clerk. He should have been a musician. In fact, I have the cornet that he played. Sits in front of me on the wall when I have breakfast every morning. He never played the cornet in my lifetime, because he used to play with his brothers. He had a brother who played the violin, another one percussion, and the third one played another instrument. He died before I was born. And when he died, my father just lost the heart to play and never played anymore. But one day, I happened to bring my cornet into the office, and Wynton Marsalis was in my office to look at a film we had just put together. Of him. And as he was leaving, I thought, oh, I tell him the story of the cornet. I brought it to him. Right away, he started playing it. That's the only time I've heard the cornet played by Wynton Marsalis instead of my father.
Did you feel that, do you get a sense that your father wasn't satiated with his profession as a postal clerk?
Well, he tried to make the best of it. And in fact, there were so few jobs during the Depression that we were lucky that we had a salaried job. And he always looked forward to the pension, which he would get after 30 years of service. He died 29 years into her service, so we never got the pension.
So what does the son of a postal clerk and teacher decide to do for a living?
Somehow, I wanted to do something great, something along the lines of Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, Pasteur, you know, one of those people, mm-hmm. Beethoven, perhaps, you know. So with that kind of dream, when I was 10 years old, I happened to pick up a book of Freud, Sigmund Freud, and I didn't understand very much of it, except that I understood that it was possible to really understand human behavior. That seemed to me to be a very, very profound and suitable task, and I became a psychologist. In fact, I worked in a mental hospital, headed up a research project at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and taught for 3 years at Boston University, all by the time I was 28. And then my adventures began.
And your first adventure was to Russia in 1955. What did you do in Russia, and why did it involve a camera?
Well, I had this passion, which has remained a very strong part of my interest, even now, a passion to portray ordinary people just as they are. So I got a tourist visa to go to Russia, a 30-day visa. Then I thought, okay, I'll bring my camera and get images of ordinary people. And since I knew so much about mental health, I would try to get into mental hospitals. A crazy idea because, you know, 1955, Soviet Union, you'd have to be crazy to get into one. You know? I remember when I hitchhiked to New York to try to get funds from Life magazine or CBS, I traveled with an old friend of ours, and all I could afford was a very cheap hotel. And the two of us, as he was trying to sleep, I would wake up every hour or so, and I'd turn to Red, and I'd say, "What do you think, I'm crazy? I don't have any permission, and I'm going with a camera that I'm borrowing from CBS, and... and he, every hour he'd say, "Oh, don't worry, it's okay, you'll be okay." Finally, 4 o'clock in the morning, again, I wake him up and he turns to me and says, "Al, you know, you're going on a lark." and it must have been at that moment that I must have smiled because going on a lark is exactly what I do. It's a chancy thing, but I'm flying high.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or film sets. Was there anything different about being in a Russian mental hospital than in a mental hospital that spoke English? Was there anything instrumental about that language barrier that was particularly striking to you in any way? Or?
Well, I try to get beyond the language barrier. And, of course, I was accompanied by the chief of psychiatry, so I wasn't being shown everything. But one thing that was quite different was that just about all the doctors were women. It sort of had a women's approach, which in some ways got beyond the politics. I had understood, and I know for sure, that there were many political prisoners who were sent to mental hospitals. I was not introduced to them, but I did get a closeness with people, and with my camera I was able to convey that. I brought back the material. I had a deal with CBS, where they would give me all the material eventually, and whatever they would use, they would pay me $1 a foot. So I made $14.
What was the state of technology at the time in the 1950s, 1960s, in terms of, you know, perhaps the sync between the audio and the picture? What did your camera look like?
Well, in 1955, the camera that I took with me was just a simple wind-up camera with reels of film that only ran for 3 minutes, and a noisy camera at that, but no sync sound, which surprised me a great deal. Nothing advanced to the point where you could really do a story spontaneously. You had to use a narrator to explain the stuff that you got on film. All that changed in 1960 when I met up with three other filmmakers, Bob Drew, Richard Leacock and Don Pennybaker, and the four of us made a film that started a whole revolution in documentary filmmaking. The film was called Primary, and it was of the election campaign between Kennedy and Humphrey. We got behind the scenes and filmed exactly what their experience was.
So in a way, technology enabled you to be a direct cinema filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Well, once I met up with these guys, we all were mutually inspired and realized that we're into brand new territory that could change the world.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Al Maisels, the documentarian, and the New York Times in 2002 acknowledged Al as the dean of documentary filmmaking. You also were considered a pioneer in the fact that you made the first nonfiction feature film. How would you describe what a nonfiction feature film is?
Well, there's always been feature films that were fiction. Dramatic films that ran at least an hour and a half or so and were really made for the cinema. But documentary, maybe feature length, that is an hour long, but not really features. The big change came especially with Salesman, a film that we made in 1968. We made it with the expectation that it would get shown in movie theaters. When we finished it, none of the cinematic chains were interested in the film. They weren't as revolutionary as we were in making in the film. But we figured out that we could start the ball rolling by renting a movie theater and showing it. So we showed the film to some 100 or so people at a screening right here in New York to raise money. And as people filed out, once they'd seen the film, they congratulated my brother and me and Charlotte Zwerin, who edited it masterfully. And I noticed through a crack in the door that there was one person left in the theater. And as she got up to leave, she turned in our direction. I saw she'd been crying. Further, as she got closer, I saw how attractive she was. And I gave my brother the elbow and I said, "She's for me." That's how I met my wife.
Oh, what is your wife's name?
Her name is Jillian. Yeah, the best thing that ever happened to me. In a funny way, it's the best thing that ever happened to the main character of the film, Paul, who's a tragic figure in that he's the most unsuccessful of the four salesmen. But he's unsuccessful because he has that much more poetry in his makeup, that much more humanity. He saw the film with us opening night, and sitting next to me, he cried at the right time. He laughed at the right time. It was his opportunity to be recognized for what he is.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels. We'll hear more from Albert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, the founder of Maisels Films, a documentary film company. He was one of the creators, along with his brother David, of the modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. And direct cinema is a way of capturing reality as life unfolds on camera without the use of narration or scripts or film sets. Why don't we play some of Salesman? This is going to be the opening of the film, the first few minutes of the film.
The bestseller in the world is the Bible, for one reason. It's the greatest piece of literature of all time. It's really tremendous, isn't it?
There's the shepherds and the three kings, flight into Egypt, the childhood of Jesus. Mary turns to Aaron, Mary finds Jesus in the temple. Well, you can see how this would be an inspiration in the home. You like that, honey? What's in there?
Christine.
Well, she's as bright, she's pretty like a mother, huh? Christine, you know what my name is?
Yes.
Paul. Paul, you know?
Paul? You have a cousin named Paul, don't you, Chris?
You can see how complete it is.
The Bible runs as little as $49.95. And we have three plans on it. Cash, COD, and also they have a little Catholic honor plan.
Which plan would be the best for you? The A, B, or C?
I'm really not interested in once I speak it over my
husband. Yeah. You wouldn't want to give him a surprise. Does he have a birthday coming up? Your lovely gift.
That's true.
We place a tremendous... The Bible is still the bestseller in the world, so...
I just couldn't afford it now, even small with medical bills.
Interesting, you know, the little girl goes over to the piano and plays a little tune totally spontaneously, something she'd made up at the moment, I would suppose, right? Every time I see that and hear that music, I think, oh my goodness, Beethoven couldn't have done any better. It was so appropriate to that moment. Mm-hmm. Now, documentaries up to that time, and even now, you know, they depend on a musical score by a composer. But this was an inherent part of it. This little child on her own expressed so beautifully what's going on in Paul's mind without even thinking of it that way.
In a way, spontaneity worked so well for you, you know, in this moment. And that happens to be the case often for you in your films, as you rely so much on spontaneity. Does it ever disappoint? Is there ever a time when nothing happens? Or how often does nothing happen when you want it to?
You just have to wait it out. It'll happen. Spontaneity for me is, it has to happen on its own for it to be true. And so when we make a film, we exercise no controls over people, what's going on. That would distort the nature of what's happening. It's chancy. I like to say that we take a chance when we have a child. Who knows what's going to happen?
Another example of sort of spontaneity in your films is a film that you've been working on for decades called In Transit.
Yes.
At first, I think it was called Fellow Passengers and then Train Stories, and now it's called In Transit. What's that about?
I get on long-distance trains in half a dozen countries of completely different cultures all around the world. And by chance, I expect that as I walk through each one of these trains, a 2 or 3 day trip for each train, I'll find somebody where there's a story about to take place when they get off the train. And I see somebody who looks a little bit nervous. Something seems to be going on, and I'll chat with them and be filming even at that time. People, as I have discovered, would like to express themselves filmically if they can trust the person behind the camera. And somehow people trust me when they see me, and how I look at them, they look back at me in a trusting fashion. I know it's okay.
Why do you think that is?
I think because I really like people. And even if it's somebody that I might not particularly care for initially, I'll discover things that I like about them. And I also would like to have this heartfelt feeling that it's very important that people be represented for who they are. And sometimes something a little bit embarrassing, but when that person sees it later on, they say, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's right. It's true.
There's one scene that I've heard of a woman you've met on the train in Pennsylvania. Could you tell that story?
The train is just leaving the Pittsburgh station, and I walk through the train. I see a woman. It looks kind of nervous. Something's going on. She's sitting at an empty table in the cafeteria coach. Sitting across from her is her little child. There I am with, at that time, a big camera on my shoulder and a sound person next to me. And I ask her if I might join her, maybe do some filming, making a film of people I meet on trains. She said, oh, please. So I began filming. And right away, she told me why she was on the train. When she was 3.5 years old, her parents broke up in an ugly divorce. And her father getting custodianship over her and vowing that her mother would never see her again. She's never seen her mother since she was 3. The night before she got on the train, she got a call from a woman in Philadelphia saying, get on the next train. I'll be waiting for you in the train station. And so when she got off the train, I kept filming. As she began climbing the stairs, a woman at the top of the stairs flung open her arms, rushed down the stairs, and there I filmed the whole encounter, ending with her mother turning to me and saying, isn't she gorgeous?
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or film sets. Your brother, David, was an integral part of your life professionally, and he passed away in what year?
1987.
How did he die?
He had a mild heart attack and got so depressed that he took some sort of medication with the warning that he shouldn't take Alka-Seltzer or I think red wine or something like that. And he mistakenly took one of those things, and that was the end.
And how did that affect your work? Because he obviously was working with you very closely.
Well, there was a young woman, Susan Fromke, who had been working with us for many years, and she took over David's role beautifully, and we continued to make films. We made a wonderful film, which she helped in the editing process, a film called Grey Gardens, showing in various forms today. There's a Broadway musical based on it.
What is Grey Gardens about?
It's about two women, the mother, 80 or so, and the daughter, 60, they're Bouviers, so they're from American aristocracy. But for 20 years, they'd been living alone in this decaying old mansion in the Hamptons. Born of American aristocracy, they couldn't quite live the way they wanted to. Mother wanted to be a singer, the daughter a dancer. And so they chose this life as recluses. They lived with so many cats and raccoons, and the whole house was kind of falling apart at that time.
Were they at all averse to providing you access to their lives?
Nothing better could have happened to them. They relished the whole idea of just being themselves. Eccentrics that they were, they were extremely entertaining, just filming them with their conversations with themselves. Really, it was a love affair, really, between mother and daughter. So intense that the daughter could never leave the house. And so it was good and not so good for both of them, but mostly good.
Have you ever had this sort of visceral desire to get involved in the lives of any people that you film because you think they're going down a wrong path? Or
I see. Well, my engagement is my disengagement. That is, I don't interfere in any way with what's going on, but I'm engaged in recognizing them and in capturing them exactly as they are. When the mother in Grey Gardens, when she was dying, her daughter turned to her, as she told me, at that moment she turned to her and said, is there something more that you want to say? And her mother responded, there's nothing more to say. It's all in the film.
You are now a father of how many children?
4 children.
How did they come to understand what their father did for a living?
Oh, well, without any purpose in mind except to entertain my kids, when they were old enough to understand a story, I would tell them stories from my own childhood. For example, I remember telling them how in the 1930s, it was the custom for the father of the family to take the strap to the child when the child misbehaved. And my father had a strap, but he would never use a strap on me. Except that once I must have done something terribly bad. I don't remember what it was. And he took the strap to me. And I think he struck me only once. It didn't even hurt. I didn't think anything of it until A few moments later, I happened to walk through the apartment. When I came into his bedroom and crossed to the other side, I turned back, and there was my father with the head against the wall crying. I stood there in total amazement, taking in this extraordinary feeling of his love for me. In all those years that went on after that, could have told me how much he loved me. It wouldn't have been quite as strong, had a strong effect as that moment.
Are there ever times when you feel frustrated because you wish you had captured a piece of reality on camera and you missed it?
Oh, yes. There have been times now when I certainly should carry a camera with me all the time.
What's an example of?
I was on a bus not so long ago, and across from me was a very much overweight black woman. And as she sat there just looking off into space, nothing was happening, but I felt some kind of anticipation of something might take place. So I nudged the woman next to me. Now the two of us, in a very kindly fashion, were looking at her. At that moment, the little girl next to her, maybe 7 or 8, got up, slipped around in front of her mother, and nestled her head between her mother's enormous breasts and fell asleep. From nothing, it just turned into a beautiful act of mother-child relationship, and should have been filming.
You have made over 36 films, and we talked a little bit about, you know, whether it's Primary or Salesman or Grey Gardens, and you've had access to Truman Capote and Marlon Brando and the Christos, who wrapped Central Park in these orange flags. How have you gotten access to these people, or how did you get access to these people very early on, like the Rolling Stones, for instance, in 1970?
It's all by happenstance, and it's different in each case. In 1964, I remember sitting at my desk answering the phone. It was the Granada Television from England calling, saying that the Beatles are arriving in 2 hours in New York. Would you like to make a film of them? I put my hand over the phone and turned to my brother and said, "Who are the Beatles? Are they any good?" My brother fortunately knew, and with a big smile on his face, he got on the phone, and we made a deal right away, rushed out to the airport just as the plane was coming down. 6 days later, we had the best film of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. Filmed as we had learned to make it, you know, totally spontaneous. You really felt, perhaps, that you were the fifth Beatle.
Going back to this access, you've had access to the Dalai Lama. What is a moment from that experience that you remember?
This was just a couple of years ago when the Dalai Lama came to New York to address many thousands of people in Central Park. When you ask for a great moment, that took place in a hotel where the Dalai Lama was staying. 5 o'clock in the morning, I was with him filming his meditation. It's one of the most powerful, memorable experiences for me as a person and for anybody who will see it. I've met people like that, Reverend Desmond Tutu, for example. He is of that ilk, and they must be represented in documentary. But then I would go all the way in the other direction, too. It's so important that we get to know ordinary people. I'm reminded of an experience that I had when my daughter, who is now 30, when she was 4 years old, there were times in the evening, maybe 10 o'clock in the evening, the two of us would go off down the street to the newsstand to pick up the New York Times for the next day. And so one day, one evening, we went to the newsstand and the paper hadn't arrived yet. And I was getting a little bit nervous. And she turned to me and said, "Daddy, the paper's not finished yet because the people haven't been killed yet." And that has inspired me to film other kinds of events other than violence and killing and so forth, and try to find, as the Dalai Lama does, to find routes to happiness.
You're considered one of the pioneers of direct cinema, where everything happens ad hoc and you're kind of just watching things unfold naturally without your having any agency.
That's right.
But was there a time before you got to that process where you were doing the traditional interviews?
Yes. Between 1955 and 1960, before we had the equipment and the philosophy, we would film in more traditional fashion.
What's an example of that?
Well, when we were in Poland at the time of the revolution there, 1956-57, we would attend a protest, for example, and interview some of the students who were protesting. They were protesting against the banning of their newspaper by the government. In fact, I remember during the protest, the police didn't know who I was. They thought I was a protester, and they hit me on the head. I got badly bruised below one of my eyes. But right away, I told them in the broken Polish that I was American, and they stopped. And that evening, I met up with a Polish friend that I had recently met, and he said, you know, Maisels, you and your brother, you know so much better than so many other Americans coming here what's going on here in Poland. You can appreciate it. But now, having been hit on the head, now you know exactly what it's like.
Was there any film that was a turning point for you financially at all? Let's talk about that issue.
Actually, when I think of perhaps the three most outstanding films that we've made, Gimme Shelter, Salesman, and Grey Gardens, Salesman certainly haven't made their money back yet. For one thing, it took over 30 years for Salesman to get on television at all, and 25 years for Grey Gardens. Gimme Shelter, we probably have begun to make a profit. It's a tough profession.
You've just moved to Harlem from where? Where were you living before you were in Harlem?
In the Dakota building where John Lennon lived.
How does a documentarian live in the Dakota?
You marry the right person.
I just want it to be on the record that in your clothes, you have a name tag on every single garment. Why do you have name tags on all of your clothes, even into your 80s?
When I was a child, I had the dream of going to summer camp, like all the other kids, but we could never afford that. And what I liked about it so much was you had to have a name tag on all your clothes when you go to summer camp. So all my clothes have name tags. I sew them on myself, whether it's my shirt or my underpants or my jacket, whatever it is, or coat.
Thank you very much for joining us, Albert.
It's expired. That was an hour? That was fast. Yeah, good.
My guest has been Albert Maisels, the documentary filmmaker. If you're interested in any of his films or to learn more about Albert, you could go to his website, maiselsfilms.com.
That's it.
You don't need the www.
Coming up, we'll hear from Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a cupcake franchise in the Middle East. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. Fadi opened the first Sugar Daddies in Amman, Jordan in 2007 when he was 30, and there are now Sugar Daddies franchises in Dubai and Beirut, Lebanon. Fadi grew up in Saudi Arabia and went to high school and college in the United States, and he's the son of Palestinian refugees. Fadi worked in marketing at Unilever prior to becoming a cupcake entrepreneur. Welcome, Fadi.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks.
When did you first discover American cupcakes?
When I was a kid growing up on this American compound that was run by an oil company in Saudi Arabia. A lot of my classmates, actually the majority of them, were Americans. And whenever they'd have me over for birthday parties or just dinners, their mothers always baked these wicked cupcakes or brownies or cookies, and I just fell in love with American desserts.
What is an American compound? Can you describe that a little bit?
It's basically this huge city within walls, and it has about 40,000, maybe 50,000 residents. So it's very self-sufficient. We've got our own school. We have our own commissary / supermarket, mail center, like almost our own government within this compound.
And you said it was the compound of an oil company. What oil company was it?
Aramco. So basically all the kids I went to school with, their parents worked for this oil company. They could be engineers or doctors. My father personally was a doctor. So because there were so many residents that there needed to be a hospital to cater to service the residents, and that's where my father worked.
And then you were educated in the United States for high school. Where did you go to college?
I went to William & Mary in Virginia.
What did you do after graduating from college?
Fresh out of graduation from college, I went back to Saudi Arabia where my parents were wrapping up their career at Aramco and heading towards retirement. But I got accepted to Unilever, and their main office was in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, which is on the western side.
Did you enjoy working at Unilever? What did you do for them?
I did. I really liked it. I worked in their marketing department, which is what I majored in college. Initially, when I first joined Unilever, I was helping the brand manager on skincare products, such as Vaseline and Pond's, and the skin lightening cream called Fair and Lovely. And then I moved on to become a brand manager on close-up toothpaste.
So how did you shift from marketing Vaseline and close-up toothpaste to running a cupcake franchise? What was the turning point?
I just knew that at some point I wanted to get out of the corporate world and do something on my own. And I went to New York on holiday, I think it was 4 years into my career at Unilever, and my friend was dying to take me to Magnolia's. And so she took me there. I fell in love with the concept, and I thought, hey, this would be a great business opportunity for the Middle East.
Magnolia Bakery, the cupcake store in the West Village, which became famous through Sex and the City, the TV episode.
Exactly.
Do you remember which specific cupcake it was that you ate?
It was the vanilla with pink frosting, which apparently is their bestseller.
And so at that moment, you sort of said, aha, I'm going to open up a cupcake shop in the Middle East. Did you think you would open up one shop? And how did you know you wanted it to be in Jordan?
Well, my parents had retired in Jordan in 2000, soon after I joined, or pretty much at the same time that I joined Unilever. And I helped my parents design their home, their retirement home. So naturally, I developed a strong emotional attachment to our house, which was in Jordan. And I told my parents one day, I want to come back and live here with you guys. I had been away from home since I was 15, and I just felt it was time to return to the nest. And my dad said, as soon as you have a business idea, let me know, and I'll be the first to back you up.
When you decided to leave your job and, you know, pursue this path of opening a bakery, when did you go to your boss and say, I'm leaving Unilever?
After I had lunch with my friend at Subway, and he told me, you know, it's now or never. I basically sat with him, and I was like, I had just come out of a really terrible meeting at work, and I was just fed up, and I was like, I really just want to be my own boss and do my own thing, and I really want to open this cupcake shop.
Mm.
He's like, well, do it. And I'm like, yeah, but I need to stick around at Unilever for a few more years and save up more money and, you know, make sure I have enough capital. And he was like, well, have you done your homework? Do you know how much money you're going to need to start up a cupcake shop in Jordan?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no, not really. I was like, but I do know I need to go to culinary school first. So I did my homework. I spent a few days researching, and I found this great culinary school in New York City. And so I applied. I got accepted. And then I went straight to my boss's office and resigned.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that resignation meeting.
It was a really nice memory because I had a really good rapport with everybody I worked with at Unilever. I was very friendly with everyone, and they were with me. And I remember telling my boss's boss that I was leaving to pursue this dream of mine, and he was like, I tip my hat to you. Well done. You know, most people spend their whole life trying to figure out what it is they want to do, and you figured it out at the age of 28. And he didn't object. He supported me, and everybody else in the company did the same. And a lot of them were very envious and jealous because they were, you know, had families and wives and children, and whose wives would divorce them if they left this, like, you know, steady, high-paying job to open a cupcake shop. So since I had no responsibilities, I could afford to do something like that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. Fadi opened the first Sugar Daddies in Amman, Jordan in 2007, and there are now Sugar Daddies franchises in Dubai and Beirut, Lebanon. So you quit your job at Unilever and you become a student at the Institute for Culinary Education in New York City. Was it the first time that you were going to be living in New York?
Yes, and that was another huge impetus for me to go to culinary school in New York, is I had fallen in love with the city over the years after I graduated from college, actually, because I had kept visiting one of my best friends that lives there. I loved the energy in the air. I loved the architecture. I loved the free spirit. There was just so many appealing things about New York, and I was like, one day I want to live here, even if for just a year.
And when you finished the Institute for Culinary Education, were you enthusiastic about rushing back to Amman, Jordan to open this cafe?
I'll have to admit, I cried the entire way to JFK Airport as I said goodbye to my beautiful brownstone apartment with exposed brick in the bedroom. So I did. I literally sat in the cab and I cried, and the cab driver thought I was off my rockers.
You do sound enamored with American culture, or at least New York culture, to some extent. And, you know, in a way, that's translated to cupcakes.
Exactly.
And how do you think locals in Jordan react to the American influence?
It has been nothing but positive, to be honest with you. It's a really good question you ask. Because, yes, there is maybe slight resentment towards the U.S. foreign policy, but not necessarily to the American culture and the American people and American products.
The price per cupcake is, you know, quite expensive for a Jordanian whose annual, you know, income is, let's say, $5,000 on average. So we're talking about a clientele that perhaps is the upper echelon of Jordanian society to some extent.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not catering to the masses of Jordanians. Obviously, the ones, you know, that are making the kind of income that you're talking about would have never heard of a cupcake. Completely alien to them, and they would not be ready to spend as much money on a piece of cake as the types of consumer that I'm targeting.
Have you thought about making a cupcake or starting a shop that is more economical, that so that more people in Jordan could benefit?
It would be very difficult because we pride ourselves on the quality of our cupcakes, and we use really expensive ingredients and imported flour and really high quality chocolate. And so it'd be very difficult for me to price it any lower than I already have in order to make it affordable without compromising on quality. So not really.
Have you injected any Middle Eastern spin into the products? We talk about how much your clients like the American culture and they appreciate just a pure American cupcake, but have you injected any Middle Eastern spin into some of the cupcakes?
I have. One of our other really popular cakes is our date cake. So dates is a huge integral ingredient in a lot of our foods, and it's very popular during Ramadan, which is the holy month of fasting that Muslims observe. She break her fast on a date. So I've incorporated dates into some of my recipes, and they're quite popular, actually.
Is that called the Ramadan cupcake?
Yes, we call it that. Well, it was called the Ramadan cupcake when I first marketed it, but now we've got clever names for all of our cupcakes, so we've named it the Blind Date.
What are some other names of your cakes? Cupcakes.
Our carrot cupcake is called the 24 carat. The banana cupcake is called Monkey Business. Mm-hmm. The strawberry cupcake is called Pink Cadillac. And the vanilla is called the Fake Blonde.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. So you started your first shop in 2007 in Amman. How did you get the word out that you were starting a cupcake shop?
Well, in the year that my shop took to complete construction, I couldn't sit around and do nothing. So I started baking from my house. I printed out my menu, and I circulated it in all the hair salons that I knew my target market would be frequenting, or the nail salons, or the gyms. And ladies started calling me and placing orders. And it was just complete word of mouth. So I had, you know, my name out even before I even opened my shop.
What was harder for you than you thought it would be?
I think the construction of the shop was a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. The first time doing it was definitely the most, one of the most difficult, challenging experiences in my life. It took me an entire year to finish an 80 square meter shop space, which is roughly about 900 square feet. That's ridiculous. It shouldn't take more than 2 months.
Why did it take so long?
Just all sorts of complications. I relied on my architect to be my contractor, which is one mistake. You can never do that. In fact, it's illegal in most countries to employ your architect as a contractor. You need to have both positions be completely separate.
You mentioned that you cried all the way to JFK when you were leaving New York to go back to Amman, to Jordan, to start this company. When you were constructing your store before you got it off the ground, did you have any moments where you were wishing you were somewhere else or not pursuing this?
You know what? No. Despite the anxiety and the stress, there was not one second where I wished to be doing something else. So I just stuck with it. I cried a lot and screamed and fought with everybody and yelled and, you know, lost a lot of hair on my head and just like, but I just kept with it.
Aside from the construction challenges, what were some of the other issues you faced in the early days?
Well, I remember, for example, having recruited kitchen staff. And I went to the local culinary school, which wasn't really a culinary school. It's more of a hospitality school. But they do give them some kitchen coursework. So I recruited, I think, 4 guys from there to work in our kitchen. And months into having recruited them, and they kept calling me to try to find out the progress on the construction, and I kept saying, one more month, and they eventually got so fed up. But I think they found other jobs, but they didn't have the courage to tell me that. So when I finally was ready to train, and we had a shop, and it was completed, and it was ready to go, I called the 4 guys, and I just told them that we were going to start training at 8 in the morning the following day. And so they said, okay, we'll be there, and none of them showed up. So on the first day of training, and we were about 3 days away from the grand opening, I had no staff in the kitchen. So I panicked, and I looked at my 4 baristas that had showed up to training, and I asked them, do you guys know of anybody that could come work for us? And they all whipped out their cell phones, made a few phone calls, and within 24 hours, I had 4 kitchen staff, new ones, that my baristas had recommended, and they are the same guys that are with me till this day.
You weren't just starting a business, but you were starting a business with ingredients that your employees never were exposed to before, or even with products that your employees had never been exposed to before. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, the one incident that sticks out in my head the most is when we first opened, you know, my staff had never been exposed to any of the desserts that we were making. So they had no idea what a cupcake was or what a brownie was, and I was teaching them stuff from scratch. So they didn't know that there was light brown sugar and dark brown sugar. They never knew what molasses was that we use in ginger snap cookies. They didn't even know what a ginger snap cookie was. And I remember telling them about the carrot cake, and I had mentioned on the task list to make carrot cake pineapple. So they just, it's like crushed pineapple in the actual cake batter. So they just, I overheard one of the guys telling the other baker, just put crushed pineapple, don't put any carrots. And I said, excuse me? He says, yeah, you said here with pineapple. And I'm like, how can it be called a carrot cake if it doesn't have any carrot inside of it? He literally just thought that you could make a carrot cake just using the crushed pineapple and you didn't need to put any shredded carrots in there. And I was just, wow, astounded. Like, this is going to be a long journey. But now my guys are better bakers than I am.
You mentioned that you had guys who were going to work for you. How come no women?
It's difficult to recruit women to work back of the house, you know, doing laborious, like, kitchen work. You mostly find women working in professional jobs here in the Middle East. Or especially in Jordan, but you rarely find like a waitress or a dishwasher or a cook. You know, they're mostly guys.
I wonder, just as you pioneered, you know, cupcakes and American baked goods in the Middle East or in Amman, Jordan, at least, if you could also pioneer having a couple of women working for you in the kitchen. What a novel concept.
Yeah. Exactly. I've had girls approach me to want to work in my bakery. But it's like, I can't, you know, they're girls from like, you know, they speak perfect English and went to school in the States and whatnot. And I'm just thinking in my head, like, do you want to work in my bakery so you can get all my secrets and then open a cupcake shop yourself in Jordan and compete with me? So there's always that threat as well.
Who funded the business?
The first shop was funded in thirds by me, by my father, my brother, and I.
What did it cost to get the whole shop up and running?
Excluding culinary school?
Excluding culinary school.
$180,000.
And including culinary school, how much is culinary school?
Culinary school plus living in New York cost me $50,000. And I paid for that personally from my savings.
So in a way, you've led somewhat of an insulated life. You grew up on this American compound in Saudi Arabia. You went to an American boarding school. You went to college in Virginia. How is it, you know, being back in Amman, Jordan, where you are not insulated anymore? Have you thought about that difference?
It's a little bit difficult, to be honest with you. But I've managed to adjust. And I think what makes it easier is that I have a loving family, and I just have a really comfortable setup in general. But it's difficult, given my upbringing, to live in as traditional and conservative of a society as Jordan is. Now, it's not, obviously, nowhere near as conservative as Saudi Arabia is, but still, it's different for me.
And how involved are you in the business now?
I'm very involved. I still, if I'm in the shop and happy birthday needs to be written on a cake, I still do that because my guys prefer my handwriting over theirs. I do the accounting on a daily basis myself, so I know every penny that's been spent and every penny that has been generated. And I still assign the task on a daily basis to my staff.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Fadi Jaber, founder of Sugar Daddies, a chain of cupcake shops located in the Middle East. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.